Okay, we're going to start the second summary session. So once again, to start off, we're going to have the tunnel group,
the boring tunnel group.
Okay. Thank you. So I'm Bert Tilley. So kind of review of the problem that was presented. So the idea is that you have a tunnel, and the tunnel can be on the order of about 18 meters in diameter. So you basically have your machine that's boring into this way. So boring in this direction, going above the surface, and this particular depth, it should be going under the surface, thank you, John, and the depth is anywhere between 4 and 80 meters, and probably a good part of yesterday, we were just trying to wrap our head around the problem, and trying to get a sense of what was actually material properties and the like. And it was very useful today because we got a chance to meet with Professor Will Bowden, and who's the chair of the Mining Engineering Department, and basically talked about one project that's actually going on in Niagara Falls where they're actually drilling a tunnel using one of these machines. And based on the characteristics that were told from us from NHI, basically there's an applied pressure that's being placed to kind of brace the whatever's being cut and kept up there, along with an applied shear stress, tau, that's being drilled. Based on that, he basically said that the material properties are more like soil or sand. Okay, so if that's the case, then you basically have a Young's modulus in an effective elastic material that's going to be comparable to what hydrostatic stresses would be based on that. Secondly, what happens in this particular situation is that you're going to get a region of where the soil or sand or things essentially fracture or crack or are allowed, basically can actually move and not act as an elastic medium. Effectively, it becomes a plastic. And so the goal would be trying to figure out what this region, plastic region, actually is. Right? So you can imagine it's cutting up, it can actually flow, and it goes in. And if this plastic region actually extends very far out or propagates up, that could actually lead to an instability because of the hydrostatic forces from the soil that's above it and possibly cause collapse. Okay, so what we were looking at, once we got that, that was a good start. And then we realized that we had to actually go and figure out how to make what are the conditions and stress that are needed in order for an elastic medium to be on plastic. And the main criterion that's used for that is what's called, what we tend to use was the Moore-Coulomb criterion, in which we assume that there's a nonlinear relation between the components of stress within this plastic medium that's actually met. Now, that actually turns out to be a very difficult problem to try to solve in full three dimensions. So we tried some simpler, at least formulating some simpler problems. One problem that we decided to look at would be to assume, instead of worrying about this machine actually going and grinding along with pushing, we just decided to stick with pushing. Okay? So what happens when you go and you formulate the problem in stress there is you get three momentum, you basically have six elements for the stress tensor. You have three displacements. You have six rate of strain components. So that's giving me 12. You have a yield stress criterion, and you have a Lagrange multiplier along with a constraint. So you end up with a closed system, but it tends to be very hard. So it's formulated, we've written it down. I don't know if it's worth the time to sit down and write it. A second problem that we looked at was actually a little more simple. So we considered it sort of a plane force. And so literally just look in the plane, and I assume that I basically have a point force that only points in the x direction, and so it's essentially acting like my tunnel. Purely Cartesian, so everything's uniform in this direction. And then the idea would be, if I go and I write this down, I effectively have a partial sigma xx with x, sigma xy with y, my delta x, delta y, and for the y component, partial sigma yy
y to 0, and then I have my Moore-Coulomb condition that would be required.
If you look at this problem, you basically have three equations and three unknowns for the stresses, and you can take a x or y derivative in terms for this Young-Coulomb condition, and you effectively have a hyperbolic system for the three components of stress. So we went through, we solved for the characteristics of that. So again, we don't know what the characteristics actually are until you solve the problem, but we know what the form of the characteristics have to be were we to know what the stresses are. And if you go and you look at this, basically the characteristics, we intuit that there's going to be a center region that we could potentially go above the axis of propagation. And inside this region would be plastic, and outside would be elastic. Or it could be that outside is plastic, or inside is elastic. We don't really. Force is going like this. I know. I realize that. So effectively, we at least came up with a closed form for what the characteristics are if we were to actually know what the solution to this particular problem is. And that's pretty much where we left off. So I'll think. One other bit that we did, we went back to the problem looking in the cross-section. So we went back here, look at the cross-section here. I have this is my shearing tunnel, end of my tunnel. I have a radius r and an outside radius r is A2. And we went through that calculation and corrected a few signs and got that to kind of work out. And basically the idea is that I have a plastic region that's within this radius r and then elastic on the outside. And I think that's pretty much where we are. The bridge. The idea of the bridge would be, again, if I look at a cross-section, so I go, I start here, cross-section, I'm going to assume the tunnel is actually fairly close to the surface, so I'm on the 4-meter side as opposed to the 80-meter side. And effectively, I have my tunnel that looks like that, and I need to worry about whether stability of the soil actually occurs very close to the surface. And the question then becomes is, can I go and figure out the effect of loading based on the surface on the soil that happens to be here? See what satisfies the Moore-Coulomb condition in terms of what turns plastic and see if this remains stable. I think that's it. Thanks.
Does anybody have any questions? They want to? No questions? Okay, let's bring up the vacuum problem, please.
I have my own code.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
I need to do this. I need this slice. Like to start by reviewing roughly what we had yesterday. Yeah, this is the model we had yesterday, and this is the equation, and this is the function. Actually, what we did today is we tried to solve it, and actually, the main thing we did is we did a lot of big discussions actually today in the model as well as in the objective function, what we actually want to minimize, and Sai was always there to help and say, this makes sense in practical way, I want to do this. So we had a very, very big discussion, and we wanted, at the same time, anyway, this modifying these things will be in one side, and we try to solve it. We decided this one to solve by using simple calculus of variations, and we started working a little bit on that. We have a Hamiltonian and set of equations, and when we were doing that, actually we had a, of course, always we get this boundary value problems, but not nice differential equation, but algebraic differential equations, so that's normally always hard to solve it. So at the same time, but we haven't solved it yet. We haven't coded it like that. So then at the same time, we wanted to modify a little bit what we can do. So what we did here is, especially for this constraint, instead of having this kind of constraint, we slightly changed actually. What we did is, now we have two more things. Yesterday, we had this both same, that is infected resistance. Now we divided, that's helpful for the practical purpose. What we did is now infected treated resistance and infected untreated resistance. Actually, this one, the whatever we treat here, this is actually the waste for us. So waste into infected treated resistance. Plus, that help us having these two more classes. That doesn't only help us for to get the detail of the problem, but also it helps when we derive the Hamiltonian and those kind of detailed things. I don't want to show that now anyway. So interestingly, instead of that constraint we had in optimal control problem, constraint we had is actually total amount of source, what is available for the treatment, total amount of doses of drugs, that is what it is. So what we wanted to do is, instead of having that as a constraint, we created one hypothetical class. Suppose that is the total amount of people we are able to solve it now. So that's the P class. The physically there is not, but we have another one class, which is the total amount of people physically we can treat them. So then we end up with this differential equation with two more. So only the change is, instead of IUR, we have now IUR and ITR. So idea is same, plus we have this one. That inequality constraint, sorry, that integral constraint is now actually the differential equations. So that makes very much easy when we do the use the calculus of variations and like that. And for that, now this is our optimal control now. That little bit discussion we did there, whether we want to solve whole integral or the final death only, basically we end up trying this anyway first, then we can always do many, many optimal control problems. So this is the one thing, this P0 equals to delta that we had in total source resources, now we had at the initial condition for the P, which is in the differential equations. So now this makes use very easy. And the final PT is we want to have is always greater than zero, because based on the differential equation in P, it's always going down. So then once it is the final, then finally we run out of the disease. We run out of the doses of the drugs. So that should always be the greater than zero. That's it. Actually, this is what we have now. We modify a little bit. At the same time, we are still in the process of solving it, coding it. So, but we don't have actual nice figure today.
Yeah. Any questions? Okay, I have one question, Naveen. So you say that P of cat P is positive, Naveen, but I mean, in actual fact, you're not going to be able to make as much doses as, I mean, what if you can't make that many doses? Have you taken into consideration if P of T is bigger than the number of doses you actually have?
Oh, this PFT?
Yeah.
But that's just only the target, but not necessarily. You are right. We might run out of disease, you might run out of doses before the PFT, right? That's the constraint we should have. You're right. We might have to change that. Yeah. Is that true, or do you have some good explanation? That's fine, right? Yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah.
P is roughly the number of doses that you have, and you want then you have doses remaining. And if you don't have the doses remaining, it means your control was bad,
right,
because you used up your dose
right,
before
right.
the end of
the right. I mean, but you could do it as if I had one dose. When do we end up? All right.
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Our next presentation is going to be NXP Semiconductors.
Okay, so I think we're good to go. So this is the NXP semiconductor problem. And just as a reminder, here's the kind of graph networks we're looking at, but this is only, say, one component of a bigger network. This was chosen because it actually fits on the slide nicer, so you can view it. So these are the kinds of things we're dealing with. We have some nodes. The nodes that are that have the red dots with a square on them, those are our external nodes, and we have some internal nodes. And the ones that are the external nodes are the ones that must stay in the system. When we do the model order reduction, the other ones are the ones that are free to leave or be adjusted. Okay, so as a reminder, we're looking at solving Maxwell's equations. And this is the linear system of equations that we get. And we're looking at mathematical and physical strategies for doing model order reduction. So we've split the group into two pieces now. One group's doing mathematical strategies, and the other one's doing physical strategies. Okay, so first is the mathematical approach. This is problem one. So we want to reduce the large resistor network. And we're using graph theory to do that. Okay, so far we've come up with a strategy for doing this, at least as a first attempt. So first we want to identify the large regions in the graph that contain only the internal nodes that we can essentially delete. So how do we choose these? Basically, we look at shortest paths. The idea is that the influence on the path resistances can be summarized by only a few new weights. Because anytime you take out nodes, you have to put something back in, because you still have to satisfy your physical laws. You have to have accurate solution to your linear system equations at the end of the day. But we're trying to identify places where you can take things out that don't matter that much. So that's step one. Step two is to identify the places where there's bridges. And the bridges will help us, once we've identified those, help us separate, connect the network into various components. Okay? And step three then will be, once we have the bridges, we can reduce the problem into the separate components. So one component would be like, for example, that graph I showed you at the beginning. And there's a certain graph theory rule that we'll use. It creates complete graphs in some of those areas. And that's the overall process. Now, there's still a remaining issue, and that's, so far we've just talked about it in terms of graph theory. We haven't looked at the weights of the resistors. So if you really want to do this right, you have to add the resistors in. And we're wondering if that's a step where you can just sort of delete edges, but we probably won't get this far by Friday. So we'll probably get through steps 1 through 3, and right now we're writing MATLAB code to do that. Okay, so here's a couple more pictures to look at. So you see kind of the things we're dealing with. Now let me get to problem two, though, that the other part of the group is looking at. So they're looking at physical approaches. And so the idea is you start out with the same linear system of equations. They need to figure out, can you come up with a reduced order model, but you should be able to actually build the circuit, essentially. Okay. So you want to have be able to build a circuit with the same linear system. The idea, though, is, of course, figuring out what sort of properties it satisfies mathematically. So so first they were looking at stability. So they decided to take, and they're using linear algebra type approaches to do this. So they took the system, and they wrote it in terms of a real part here and an imaginary part. Okay, and once they've done that, that's sort of the starting point, and then they want to try to answer these three questions. So first of all, in order to look at stability, you have to look at the eigenvalues. You want to figure out if they all lie in a certain half plane. And then you want to know if this also happens for the reduced system once you've taken out some of your nodes, okay? And then last, can you actually write that in terms of R tilde, L tilde, C tilde? In other words, can you actually build the circuit at the end of the day? So that part of the group has made some progress on answering the first question. So they were able to answer the part about all the eigenvalues being in the left half plane. And that was basically using linear algebra. I think they actually have the proof in here. I won't be able to go through it, but using linear algebra. And they've also made some progress on the second part as well. So probably in tomorrow's update, there'll be more details on those two, but I think that's where they're at right now. So conclusion answered. The conclusion for question one is yes. All the eigenvalues are in that half plane. Okay?
All right. Any questions? Okay, thanks again.
Thank you.
Okay,
is it turned on?
Yes, you are.
Good. Okay, I should present the what we have conducted on the HIV problem, and it's actually revealed here. So I can go down again. You just read the blackboard. But let me explain a little bit on what we did up to this morning. This here is a model of a cell, and there's a particular pathway we are looking at called the NF-kappa-B pathway. And NF is some kind of a protein molecule, kappa-B is also, they attach together and form this NF-kappa-B. There's an inhibitor to this molecule called I-kappa-B, which simply attach to NF-kappa-B. If a cell is attacked, for example, by a virus, then in the one signal molecule, signaling there's something wrong is TNF. There's a receptor in the cell membrane, and this can activate another protein called IKK. IKK can act on I-kappa-B by marking it with 2-phosphate and something more, and then there's coming a chewing type of molecule and destroys this one here. NF-kappa-B, when this inhibitor is destroyed, can then enter the nucleus of the cell, and then it can make a together with DNA, it can make a transcription of I-kappa-B. And so this is the closed loop, and yesterday we made a model of this. Y dot function of T, the vector, equals some, let's call it G of Y. And it's Y has a dimension 4. So that's what we studied yesterday. And today we actually would like to extend this and come a little bit closer to the control by such an external species like TNF. There are actually more controls that we concentrate on just this year. So today we have set up, added to this model here, we have added a model of this part, which forms a control. And this molecule here we refer to as AC for brevity. This molecule is BC. C is for the cytoplasm that is out here. And this here will then be a combination of a compound of AC-BC. So if we should look at, for example, this reaction here, we have AC-BC plus, and we then need an active part of IKK, and that I call DA. And we have a reaction with a reaction constant K5, and this then gives AC. And okay, and it gives also an inactive version of IKK. So it looks like this. Yesterday, our reaction was that we didn't distinguish between these three different type of IKK. So here stands just D, and our total reaction was from AB to A through K5, and then the concentration of D was assumed to be constant and incorporated in K5. But now we have made this modification. We put an A and an I on here today, and then we add with an equation of a neutral IKK plus, actually there's some ATP because there's a phosphorylation taking place on top of this one here to mark it for destruction. And here we have a K6 gives ADP plus DA. And here again we will consider the concentration of ATP and ADP constant incorporated in K6. So now we have the new equation from DN to DA. So now we have a new equation. Y dot of C equal, and it's not G but F of Y, and the dimension is now 6. Let's see, how does the solution for one of the components look like? The one of the components we are most interested in is in NF kappa B. So let me write that here. And here's time. And if you have no TNF, that means you have no attack on the cell, we can put K6 to 0, and then concentration of this here will more or less be 0. And let's say up to here. Okay, if we have K6 different from 0, turn that on. Then after a transient, we'll go to a fixed state of the concentration of NF kappa B. So here we have our infection taking place, and K6 different from 0. we look today at a simplified version of this, that is simplified. There was six ordinary, couple ordinary differential equation nonlinear, and we put all parameters to 1 except 2, lambda and mu, and then we made a discussion of it, found out that there was actually a fixed point for K6 different from 0. It will translate to at this place here. The problem is that this level do not depend on the actual value of K6. So if you are putting f of y equals 0 and find the stationary point, then you see the stationary concentration of NF kappa B is independent of K6. We are unhappy about that, and that's something we'll think about tomorrow. And then when K6 is equal to 0, then this is 0. The situation yesterday was that when we had a D here and omitted this equation, that is, just looked at this part here, there the infection was modeled through K5. And we had a somewhat similar problem, but the level depended on K5. So somehow we have gone from better to worse, maybe, even though we think we have been more. You disagree. Okay, that's fine. We will discuss that. maybe we have to think about the structure of our system of ordinary differential equations here and do some different modeling. But we would like to make contact to the HIV through this contact here. Okay, that's all.
Any questions? Sanjeev, do you have any rebuttal? Did you set it?
One of the issues in the HIV field is exactly what's happening to NF kappa B, because it's really important to identify the how NF kappa B changes in response to the virus or the cellular defense response. Those are very hard to distinguish when an infection happens. So when you look at the literature, the data changes. Sometimes you see NF kappa B going down, sometimes you see NF kappa B going up, and it's very confusing what's happening during the infection. So part of why I'm at this workshop is trying to understand, come a more rational way of trying to understand if we could see what's happening to NF kappa B in a reduced model. And yesterday it was kind of exciting because, you know, there was a relationship between one of the important parameters and NF kappa B levels. And today, it went away when we added a couple of differential equations. At first, I was worried about it when I had lunch and thought a little bit more about it. And it changed the problem from yesterday. I would have developed a drug against IKB, a drug against the complex. But after today, I'd probably develop a drug against the receptor. So it changed. It's identified where I would perhaps attack the pathway. Maybe the parameters are all wrong and all the rest of it, but it's a rational way of me thinking about where I would design a drug. So I wouldn't say from you know,
okay,
better to worse. I would say I need to identify the TNF receptor IK activation mechanism a little bit better to get better parameters on those to see if that's still true.
Thank you. Does anybody else have any questions? All right, can I get Maple Ridge, please?
Okay, I will report what we have done today. We didn't get very satisfactory results. Well, indeed, we have several approaches under the table, but we decided not to show you unless we have very good progress. So this is what we got today. And, you know, my teammates reported yesterday. Our data is very unstationary, so it will be very desperate to find such strategies that in the very beginning, we just put money, we allocate the money into each strategy, and after thousands of days, we find, oh, the sharp ratio is also very high, so that's desperate to find such strategy. So our approach today is to find the reallocation method. So what does the reallocation mean? We set up a frequency, we reallocate the money into each strategy, and when we reach the reallocate date and we optimize the portfolio and we find the optimized weight and we reallocate the money into each strategy again. And of course, if there is no transaction cost and we reallocate the money every day, we can get a very good result. But badly, we have to give money to others about the transaction cost. So we have to find, we want to see if there is a best time, best reallocation frequency that will make the highest Sharpe ratio. So this is the final result we got. And this is the semi-annually Sharpe ratio with different reallocation frequency. And we can see, yeah, if we reallocate the money too often and the result is very bad, it's very low. And if the frequency is in the 30 and 60, the separation will be very high in the end. And separation is the mean, sorry. It's just the mean of the portfolio over the variance of the portfolio, the term. So this is separation. This is a very sensitive object function, but this is just what exactly we want to optimize in the end. And this is the annual sharp ratio with different reallocation frequency. And it's the same if we reallocate the money too often. We have very bad sharp ratio. And if the frequency is 60 days, which means we reallocate each 2 months, and the sharp ratio in the end is highest. However, this curve is not what we exactly want. We just want the curve like the baby's cry face is under this curve. So we'll check exactly tomorrow if it's because of the real data. You know, the real case sometimes will make big jump in the return, or it's maybe some little bugs in the complicated code. So, okay, that's all for today's work.
Yes, just a second. Oh, yeah. So, what are those graphs showing? Like, what would be good and what would be?
Oh, this the y-axis is the value of the sharp ratio in the end, right?
Right.
So, what we want to do in our project is want to optimize the sharp ratio in the end. So higher the sharp ratio is, the result is better.
So would it be right to expect that if you reallocated more frequently, that should help you to get a better sharp ratio?
In fact, if there's no transaction cost, yes, you are right. But because we have transaction cost, if we reallocate too often, and the result is bad.
Okay. So how much? That's slightly downward sloping, but only if you blur your eyes. Like how much of the transaction costs kind of screwing things up at the frequent reallocation end of the scale?
Pardon?
If you took out transaction costs, how much higher would it be at the low allocation frequency?
We didn't calculate that, but of course, because the optimization of the portfolio is based on the sharp ratio at that point. So it means we want to make the sharp ratio in that point higher than we have the optimized weight. So if we optimize it every day, the sharp ratio is always kept on the highest level. And so the next day, you know, in the market, only one day, the market variable will not change so much. And so if we take out the transaction cost, I think the sharp ratio will be much higher in the very beginning. But if it's long, it will, you know, the data is unstationary, so the result may be very frequency. So, yeah.
Could you please comment a little bit why you have decided on the sharp ratio as the major measure? Have you tried any other measures, how your different allocation frequencies would look like with respect to other measures?
In fact, I think you can ask the company why they want me to optimize this operation, this benchmark. Yeah, in fact, I ever did some research about this. This is very sensitive benchmark. So it means if the tiny change between the mean return of the portfolio, this benchmark will be moved so much. So, yeah. In my opinion, this is not a good benchmark. at least maybe sometimes we can minus the risk free. So that's in my opinion, but that's not our task in this week. So.
Maybe we're going to get a visit from Roger. Do you want to thank the speaker? Can we have hospital for sick kids, the brain people, please?
I might speak for slightly longer today, but I promise it won't be too much longer. So let me remind you what it is that we're doing and maybe give a little more detail than I gave yesterday. We have a brain. I should have left this from yesterday, shouldn't I? And inside the brain there's lots of activity. And around the outside of the brain, we have some sensors. And so the activity inside the brain, we can think of as lots of little dipoles that create a kind of changing magnetic fields. And these sensors around the outside detect that. And what we're interested in finding is, so in an ideal world, what we would detect is a kind of a signal here that went into what we call synchrony with a signal over here. So if we could identify kind of patches of the brain that for a brief period of time begin to kind of behave in the same way, the magnetic field varies in the same way, either oscillates in the same way or either pulls in the same way, then that would be that would be kind of, I think that's what the researchers want. So today, okay, we can be looking at four things today. Let me go through them kind of with a little bit of detail. So the first thing is, how do you detect, so you've got the signals coming out of here, they look very, very noisy. So how do you determine when two signals are, you know, when you're going to decide that two signals are kind of are in phase, are phase locked? So let's say we've got some S1 here, S1 of T, and to a T, you know, over here. So the measure that they, the measure that Lewis uses, which I think is standard kind of throughout this thing, is to use a Hilbert transform so that you can create a kind of a from your signal you can create a phase. And similarly for this guy. And then they, over a little time, over kind of, they pick a time window and look at the average over that time window of the difference between these phi, so difference between phi 1 and phi 2. And the point is that if these guys are sort of doing the same kind of thing, then this difference will be constant, and so this will be close to what this will be one. If these guys aren't phase locked, this will be zero, you hope, but definitely not one. So the first thing that we're looking at today is when Lewis approaches this problem, he takes these signals. He doesn't immediately apply this process to generate this phase. He filters at a particular frequency, and that seems problematic, because when you filter at a particular frequency, you're already throwing away lots and lots of information. So how do you know that what you have after you filtered at a particular frequency is still something that you can reasonably begin to kind of compare the phase? Right? Filters using a very narrow bandpass filter. So we thought about that for a little while. I don't think that we came to any conclusions. We then decided to look at different measures of synchrony. So this is there's some, this makes sense, and actually kind of there's some this is just a small little picture of kind of what's actually involved in doing it. But there are other things that you might think about doing. You might think about just looking at correlation between the signals. You might try and do some other kind of fitting of the two signals together. So in what sense can we say anything about when different measures of synchrony are better, one measure is better than another measure. Can we, in particular, can we find things that give kind of a very strong measure with one approach and a weak one with the other, and vice versa. So there've been some people looking at that. What else? Oh, we also kind of realized that, again, so from a paper that Lewis brought, is that, so this is a very non-linear measure. And what's happening, every kind of model of what's going on in here, we assume a linear superposition of the contributions of all of these dipoles coming out to each of the sensors. But then we've got this non-linear measure on the outside. So if we begin to compare the synchrony between two sensors here, does that mean anything at all about the synchrony between what's happening in there? And that's really Lewis's work in the paper that he brought, but that was something that we read today and realized was an issue today. We don't have any answers for that. So then the things which we've made more progress on, I think, today, we've been looking at just solving the forward problem. So starting with a so if you this is standard physics, but if you've got a dipole here and you've got a sensor up here, this is a normal direction, this is the vector between them, if the field at that point has strength Q, if that dipole has strength Q, then you can write down what field you measure here. It's Q over R cubed 3 R n hat over R squared minus M, and the unit product of M and M. So we can take that, and we've been developing a code that allows us to put in various dipole measurements to see what we measure on the outside. And then we've also been looking at the inverse problem. So kind of given what we see at the sensors, what can we conclude about what happens on the inside? And we've been looking at that really in the context of I think kind of one of the key problems that Lewis was interested in, which is that suppose that he's got two nearby sensors and the signal at those sensors is synchronized. Does that, at what point, how far away from me, so the synchrony could come from the fact that you've just got one dipole here that's affecting those two sensors. Or it could come from two dipoles that are acting synchronously. So how can you tell the difference between those two situations? Well, it's kind of clear that if you've got an R cubed on the bottom here. So if your sensors are a long way away from each other and you see some synchrony happening there, that's either coming from a very, very strong signal, or it's coming from two things which are local to the sensors but then are synchronized kind of at a distance. So we've been asking the question, well, when you've got three sensors we've been looking at. What patterns kind of at each of these sensors could be attributed to just one dipole, or what patterns could you see here that what kind of patterns could you see here that would tell you for definite there's more than one dipole that's created that? And we've been doing that really not thinking about synchrony at all, just thinking about a particular signal, but we hope to combine that then with measuring synchrony to maybe get some way of getting better resolution than Lewis is currently able to get on his measurements.
Thanks, Joel. Any questions?
Yeah. No. So if you looked at, suppose you had one dipole under each sensor, in principle you could write that as a linear system that basically each sensor hears all the dipoles at different magnitudes because you know what the magnitudes are. So in principle you should be able to, given a sensor readings, be able to back out what the dipoles.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, there's two problems. The first is that in reality there are millions of dipoles, so the inverse problem is ill-determined. Secondly, because of the non-linearity in the way that you so you say, okay, well, I don't care about the millions. I'll approximate little groups of dipoles with one dipole. But then you've got this very non-linear measure of synchrony. Well, but that's eventually kind of what you want. That's what we want to detect. So you're approximating dipoles with a linear combination of them. But then if you apply the nonlinear measure, I mean, does it make any sense what you're doing after that? Yeah. We've thought about other groups have done that, and they've considered more realistic physics than we're thinking about here, I think. So they've looked at the effects of the skull and stuff, and so.
Okay, we can thank Joel once again. So our last talk is Manuel.
So I think we've been making pretty good progress with the Manulife problem. Briefly, what's happened over the course of today and maybe late yesterday, we've restricted our attention we're analyzing these target date funds, first of all, but we've restricted our attention to thinking about these things as a certain kind of optimization, stochastic optimization problem, with basically the hope that this is going to help us characterize these things. And we've broken down what we're doing into a number of tasks. So we have several groups going on at once. So if you remember from yesterday, what the basic picture of these things is that we have some market with bonds, stocks, and some sort of employment income stream. And these investment vehicles take your money and invest it. I mean, this is invested in the market, like the bond and stock market, in some sort of using some sort of strategy that is apparently ideal for you. What does that mean, ideal for you? Well, that means think of you have some sort of utility function, and they're trying to optimize that somehow. So what are they trying to optimize? Well, say you have some sort of wealth at time t, which is a combination of your holdings and your employment income. And with this investment vehicle, this is also a function of the your allocation, basically. This is the proportion of wealth in stocks at times t, this omega. So this is what we're referring to as the glide path, often, of these things. So the problem we're looking at is simply given a specific utility function. For example, one of them. So utility might be, so this is the expected utility,
your wealth.
Some power, 1 minus gamma. So the idea is, the optimization problem is to try to pick a glide path, omega, that optimizes this expected utility. This, with some stochastic analysis, leads you to Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equations, which in some simple cases we can solve analytically. So we have this nice case that we can solve for the optimal glide path and even the optimal utility at the terminal investment time. What we're working on today and will be tomorrow is modifying that. So we're modifying the employment income stream model, and we can do a little bit of analytic stuff with that, but we've got people working on numerics for finding this optimal glide path, omega. And also what we're working on too is just doing some Monte Carlo simulations, more for visualizing these things and giving interpretable results. So, but to do the Monte Carlo stuff, you need to come up with these either optimal glide paths or the glide paths that are reported by the various companies. So you take those glide paths and then compute some more interpretable statistics from them that maybe you can use to think about which funds are better for you. So that's about it.
All right, thank you. So any questions for David?
There's no mention of risk in your utility function.
Pardon?
The risk?
Well, the noise appears. So we have noise in here and here. And everything here is, I mean, I haven't written down the formula, but this wealth is a combination of these three things, this simple market.
You're optimizing over the mean, I guess.
The mean of a utility, yeah. So basically what you can, that's a little bit unintuitive maybe. Is that okay? Or?
I guess just the standard deviation of...
So you have this 1 minus gamma. So the way I think a little bit about utility is that, so the first thing, nice thing to do would be to just optimize the mean, and then, but maybe you want to bring in some higher moments. That's kind of what this is. So you can think of maybe you're bringing in higher moments and trying to minimize things like the standard deviation. This isn't just some combination of mean and standard deviation, right? This utility is some special function. It has some interpretations, yeah?
Yeah, the risk of different people, the risk of deviation.
Okay, any other questions? All right, well, I thank David. Okay. Before we break, I've got two announcements. One is, I only have 7 common balls. Now, I know there's a lot more common balls out there. Please, if you have any that you've recorded, pay attention to what your colleagues are saying. Write down the stuff that, I'll be polite. Write down any common balls. remember to shovel, right? Okay. The other announcement is, I've handed out 6 keys. Please check if you have a bird on your key. If you have a bird on your key, come find me. Well, if you don't give me the bird, you will have a prize. That was a pun. All right, well, thanks a lot. Keep working. Very important. Yes, Chris. All right, no reports tomorrow evening. Executive decision.